Welcome to Mind, America's Lignite Energy Podcast, brought to you by the Lignite Energy Council of North Dakota. Here's your hosts, Kate Muggerud and Jeff Simon.
Okay, welcome. Thank you guys so much for joining us on this episode of Mind, Lignite Energy in America. I have my co-host with me, Jeff Simon. Jeff, thanks for joining us today. Guys, today we have a great guest with us, Robert Bryce. Robert Bryce is a man of many trades. He is an author, a producer, a filmmaker. Robert, all the things. You are just a man of many talents. Like I said, an energy expert, which is why we have you on the show today. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you, Kate. Thanks.
Okay, so I just listed off all of these different titles. I don't know how you sleep at night with the amount of things that you have going on. What's a day in the life look like for you?
Well, I've been busy lately. I was at a battery plant on Monday morning, and then on Tuesday morning, I was testifying before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee this week. So it's been kind of a head-spinning week, honestly. But I've been traveling a lot, doing a lot of speaking engagements. You know, with these energy prices surging, people are really interested in it. But I'm publishing a podcast a week, and I don't have any more books in the hopper. But yeah, regularly writing on what's going on, and then my Senate testimony, I think, was 3,200 words, so I put a lot of effort into that. But this is important, and I think in retrospect, having come up and seen the lignite operations that you have in North Dakota. It is remarkable just in the last few weeks how the importance of energy security and on-site fuel has been proven yet again in Europe, because they're relying on the Russians, long import lines, supply lines, and it's crippling their economies all across the continent.
When you were here in late September, you were here for the Lignite Energy Council's fall conference, and we're a keynote speaker there. I wrote an article about your presentation, and the headline quote I put in there was that U.S. energy policy right now is deeply dangerous. Those were the two words you used to describe it, deeply dangerous. And that was kind of your message to the Senate Energy and Commerce Committee this week in your testimony there. Give us a rundown of what you told them, or tried to tell them anyway.
Sure. Well, the punchline that I told them was that they need a big dose of energy realism and an even bigger dose of energy humanism. That all these claims around this idea that we're going to run the world on renewables alone are being disproved very vividly in Europe, where you're seeing rising levels of energy poverty, where the largest trade union in Europe recently warned that they have something close to 2.7 million members that they believe won't have enough energy, affordable energy, this winter. You have fertilizer plants that are shutting down, which will have knock-on effects in terms of food prices, not just in Europe, but around the world. These fertilizer plants all across Europe and in Asia have been shutting their doors because they're paying five times as much for their natural gas in Europe as we are in the U.S. And then you have the other part of the deindustrialization, closure of steel mills. And then, they don't have enough natural gas. They've underinvested in hydrocarbons and overinvested in renewables. And now when it comes to imports, they're not completely dependent, but largely dependent on Gazprom and Vladimir Putin. And that's a bad person to count on. I mean, you're going to bet your country's economy on Russia and Gazprom. That it's deeply dangerous.
Man, I didn't know gas prices were five times. I can't even imagine what that looks like for, somebody, average homemaker. That's intense.
Right. I mean, the lease, the NBP, the balancing point in Britain, I think it's been $25 or $27 per million BTUs. At Henry Hub here in the U.S., it's been fluctuating between $5 and $6. So, that is a massive number. And then further, that's going to translate into the electricity sector because they're so dependent on gas for electric generation. So you had just earlier this week, in fact, the day before I testified before the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, the spot price for electricity in Britain hit $4,000 a megawatt hour. Why?
Whoa.
Because the wind wasn't blowing. So, great. So climate change, we're going to have more extreme weather in the future. Well, then why would you ever stake your energy and power systems on weather-dependent renewables? It just makes no sense at all.
Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of overinvestment. You talked about that, overinvestment in that. And it's great when it works, when it's blowing. I mean, I saw instances this week with the Southwest Power Pool where more than 60% of the electricity was coming from wind. But obviously when that happens, I mean, it's a good thing. There's no fuel cost with that. But when it happens, those baseload plants that we've talked about, they're not making any money. How do we keep those viable if we're going to continue to add more renewables, Robert?
Well, this is one of the problems that's occurring in RTOs all around the country, and that you have these thermal plants that have relatively high fixed costs and relatively high fuel costs that are having to compete in a wholesale market against heavily subsidized renewables, wind and solar, that have zero fuel costs. So I've done the calculations, I've written about it in Forbes, that the federal incentives, the tax incentives for wind energy are something on the order of 250 times as large as what's given to nuclear. The wind energy sector is getting 160 times more per unit of energy produced as the nuclear sector. So, you know, this is fundamentally distorting the wholesale energy market, wholesale electricity market in the U.S. And unless or until we get rid of these insane subsidies, and that is, they are insane. And but, you know, the House Democrats are pushing for an extension, in fact, a permanent making those production tax credit, the investment tax credit permanent in the tax code, which, again, would be ruinous for reliability, affordability and resilience.
We saw that in the Senate hearing where some of the Senate Democrat members were actually defending wind because it's quote unquote cheaper than natural gas or coal or nuclear. But it's also unreliable. How do you ever get that point across to people who, you know, tend to ignore the need for reliability?
Well, you know, it's hard because so much of the time the weather is, you know, isn't, you know, it's not terrible, right? And so this idea, oh, well, we have to plan for and pay for, because that's part of it. You cannot, you have to pay for that resilience and reliability. It's not free. Mm-hmm. And people don't want to pay for something they're not, they don't think they're going to use. But therein lies the problem, Jeff, is that to properly run the grid, you have to plan for those extreme scenarios and you have to pay for it. And right now, the way the RTOs are set up in ERCOT and particularly in California being the obvious examples, they aren't ready for this. They aren't able to, that within their own systems, they can't give the proper incentives to assure resilience and reliability.
So that brings up a point that I always like to talk about with people who are from Texas. And you know, that's the blackouts that you experience there. Talk to me a little bit about how, you know, were you affected? I'm sure you were. And then also kind of what's the lesson then for policymakers from that?
Sure. Well, I'll tell you, and I've said this many times, that being blacked out for 45 hours as we were starting at 2 a.m. on February 15th, it really changed how I think about these issues. And I've written about energy and power systems now for 30 years. But after being blacked out for 45 hours, it concentrates the mind. Yeah. And so really since that, you know, that blackout, I've been continually looking at how, what happened and why. Mm-hmm. And the short answer is this was a government failure, that policymakers were created a market badly designed that did not provide the sufficient incentives for resilience and reliability. Mm-hmm. And further, you have $66 billion spent on renewables in Texas in the years before the blackout. And all, essentially all of that money was wasted in terms of resilience and reliability, because none of that solar and wind, effectively none of it was right. available when the grid went into crisis. So that's the first takeaway. And then the second, and there was an interesting report that was issued by the FERC just in the last few days, talking about the need for on-site fuel, which is a point I made in my August 1st piece in the Dallas Morning News, that the plants that did the best during the power crisis were the coal and the nuclear plants.
Yeah.
You mentioned FERC just now there, Robert. There's a new commissioner on FERC now. They're back to five members. Willie Phillips came from the District of Columbia's Public Service Commission. And I was reading an article about him. He's been criticized by environmentalists, but he's also described himself as a climate activist, and he's concerned about that. You know, really, when you talk about some kind of market reform where the RTOs maybe have a little bit more power to focus on reliability and what they need, does that direction come from FERC ultimately, or how do, I mean, whose decision is this?
You know, that's a good question, Jeff. And I'm not certain that I can answer it, because you've got a number of overlapping jurisdictions, right? You have the state level public service commissions, and then you have the RTOs that fit over that. And then you have the FERC that sits on top of those, right? And then you have subsets within each of those with different balancing authorities, the, mm-hmm. you know, the cooperatives, the publicly owned utilities. So I wish I knew, but I think that one of the, and I could give you a pat answer. I can't, because I think I know the oil and gas business pretty well. The electricity business, it is so complicated. I mean, just thinking about the regulatory part of this, this is why there's so many successful lawyers and lobbyists in the business, because it's crazy. It's crazy complicated.
That's what we see at the state level. We see a lot of this, your fault, you know, finger pointing. And at some point, somebody's got to assume control and step up and fix this, or we're going to have blackouts this winter and people are going to die.
And that's what we saw in ERCOT, was in the wake of the blackouts, the buck doesn't stop anywhere. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, this idea, oh, well, it's a market. Well, it has aspects of a market, but it's a network. It's an it's essential service. And I think that the way I think about it is there's a misapprehension by policymakers of what the electric grid is and what electricity is. It ain't hot dogs. It ain't tennis rackets. It's mm-hmm. an absolutely critical service that cannot be allowed to fail. And if you think about it that way, it takes the idea of selling watt hours isn't as important mm-hmm. as the absolute essentiality of providing watts when watts are dear.
Mm-hmm. You previously mentioned coal when we were talking about the blackouts. How important do you feel coal will be in our nation's energy future?
Well, you know, first I'll say, you know, going to the, was it tell me the Young plant, was that the one that I visited, Jeff?
Yeah, Milton R. Young.
Yes. Milton yep. R. Young plant.
Yep.
I was amazed. I love big iron. I love mm-hmm. industrial facilities. I just mm-hmm. love seeing the ingenuity at work and how, right. you know, massive machines work. And mm-hmm. I just find it all just endlessly fascinating. And it's mm-hmm. very lucky in my career to go to refineries and power plants and nuclear mm-hmm. power plants, above ground mines, below ground mines. But I think that what clearly was one of the messages, the outcomes from ERCOT, was that the plants that had on-site fuel are the ones that performed the best. Further in traveling since then, in talking to, I was in Missouri and Branson talking to people in the Associated Electric Cooperatives, they had their own balancing authority. They didn't lose, not one of their customers had a single minute of blackouts, mm-hmm. right? But they weren't covered by the RTOs. And what do they rely on? They rely on coal. So mm-hmm. will coal have a renaissance or resurgence after we get past some of this energy crisis? Maybe. Mm-hmm. What is clear is the EIA has said coal use in the U.S. will be the highest this year in 2021 as it's been since 2014. So wow. this rush away from coal toward natural gas is retrenching a little bit as utilities mm-hmm. look around and say, whew, that gas at $5 or $6 is not as economic as it was when it was at $2. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that and it was one of the points I made in front of the Senate was we need to be really careful because we're not paying attention to all these issues that come together mm-hmm. around affordability, mm-hmm. resilience, and reliability.
There is one area I see where maybe a shift is beginning to occur. And you mentioned it again in your Senate testimony, which, by the way, I'd encourage someone, go to the U.S. Senate website, find that energy committee and read the testimony, because you lay it out, you explain why Europe's in the mess that is, why this decarbonization is not achievable in the short term. But ultimately, we've had underinvestment, which we really haven't talked about yet, right? We're underinvesting in fossil fuels, this whole crazy ESG movement. But I'm beginning to see maybe a little bit of shift there. Some people are kind of going, oh, yeah, maybe we ought to spend a little more on fossil fuels.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the ESG part of that, because I was talking just this morning to someone whose principal production is in Arkansas, and their company, they're seeing a difficulty in getting, not just his company, but across the oil and gas sector, getting enough capital committed from banks to allow them to continue investing. So, you know, the problem there is this, if we have chronic underinvestment, well, it's going to mean drastically higher prices because mm-hmm. there's an inelasticity of demand. We're not going to change over our auto fleets or our industrial boilers or our home boilers, home heating units to heat pumps or whatever else for decades. We're going to need hydrocarbons for decades to come. So if we choke off that the production, the upstream end, it's going to be very painful throughout the economy. And who's going to pay the most? The poor and the middle class.
I was looking at one of the charts in your testimony, and this ought to tell people what's really going on here. You compare U.S. primary energy consumption and the source of it from 1985 till 2020, last year. In that 35-year period, we went from 90% dependence on fossil fuels. We're all the way down to 82 now.
Right.
I mean, that ought to tell folks something.
Yeah. And we're getting 18 times as much primary energy from hydrocarbons as we are from wind and solar combined. So this idea that we're going to suddenly make this big shift, particularly given all the land use conflicts that are happening around solar and wind. Now, let's be clear. The land use conflicts aren't limited to solar and wind. Natural gas pipelines, oil pipelines, Keystone XL, all of those things. Yes. Line 5, you know, all these pipelines are having trouble with siting and getting construction permits. But imagine you're trying to put that pipeline 200 feet in the air with a high voltage transmission line. It's not going to happen. And one of the most interesting political developments, the political votes around November 2nd, a lot of attention on the you know, Glenn Youngkin being elected in Virginia, rightly so. Mm-hmm. But the November 2nd referendum in Maine, where Maine voters by a margin of 59-41 rejected a high voltage transmission project. So it should tell you that, well, this is an example of the rural resistance to these large infrastructure projects that involve putting massive high voltage transmission projects across their lands. And that's what's going to be needed if we're going to build out renewables at scale. But this is something that, frankly, and I have to put it like it, say it like it is, these elite academics who publish these studies and the politicians and the Sierra Club and the Natural Resource Defense Council, they don't want to talk about any of that because it ruins their narrative that, oh, well, of course, we can do all this and wind and solar are cheaper. Yeah. Okay, well, how are you going to connect it? It's this eliding over some of the key issues that they just don't want to talk about.
That's one of the things I shared with you. It was from a slide presentation a couple of years ago that MISO put together, the Midwest's independent system operator. When you try to imagine the footprint, you know, what it's going to do to the landscape if we ever, you know, get anywhere close to 100% renewables. I mean, the public's just not going to accept that destruction of the viewshed, if you will. I mean, they're not going to tolerate it.
I like that idea too, and because that's one of the lines that, you know, is common now, social license. You know, are we going to get the social license to operate? Mm-hmm. Well, and what you see now, and I mean, just in the last few months, we've had large-scale solar projects rejected in Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Montana. In fact, in Montana, it was in Butte, about an 800-megawatt solar project. So, you know, these are massive projects that the local governments, local residents are saying, we don't want these in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Go find them somewhere else, but not here.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Robert, I know you've traveled the world and you're very well traveled, and you specifically traveled studying energy. Talk to me a little bit about the countries that you have seen that use affordable, reliable energy versus countries that don't. Do you see differences there?
the answer would be yes. You know, we went to, so my, the film that I made, and I made a film, and at the same time I wrote my new book, A Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations. We went to India, Iceland, Lebanon, Puerto Rico, Colorado, New York. I've been in the last few months, I've been into Louisiana in the wake of Hurricane Ida. What I know is that no matter where we went, we saw the iron law of electricity, which is people will do whatever they have to do to get the electricity they need. People, businesses, countries, they will do whatever they have to do to get the electricity they need. They're not going to stay in the dark. So we saw that in Beirut, where local people will pay the generator mafia. And today Beirut is in complete chaos, and the entire country of Lebanon is in economic collapse. In India, we saw people stealing electricity because they couldn't afford it. And that was kind of, you know, the authorities looked the other way because they were so poor, you know, the locals were so poor, this is how they were going to get along. And so there wasn't, you know, some rigorous enforcement because there, you know, it was a weak civil society. You know, but then contrast that with Iceland, where everybody's rich and everybody's beautiful and everybody has enough hot water, and you can stand in the shower for a day or two or three or four because there's endless amounts of hot water because of geothermal. So, and they're attracting industries from all over the world, including Bitcoin miners and the rest of it, because their electricity is so cheap. So electricity is fundamental. It is the most important form of energy. It's the fastest growing form of energy. And I'll just add one other quick point, which is it's absolutely essential if we're serious about bringing women and girls out of the dark and into modernity. That electricity brings women and girls, or frees women and girls from the pump, the stove, and the washtub. It is absolutely essential. And as we saw it all around the world, where, you know, in poor countries where if women don't have electricity, they're effectively household servants and slaves to the wash, the carrying the water, heating the water, cooking over dung or wood. And this is the lot of not just a few, but billions of women in the developing world.
You know, the same people that are advocating these forms of renewable energy that are driving up energy prices are the same people who would, claim to be advocates for the poor. Well, I mean, low-income Americans or low-incomes in people anywhere pay a disproportionate share of their income on energy, I would think. And that's a point you made, you know, during your testimony as well, that, I mean, just think of the impact this is having on low-income Americans.
Well, and I thank you for pointing that out. And that was the, you know, we hear over and over, and I'm just sick of it, frankly. I just, you know, it makes me disgusted to hear, just energy transition and, you know, energy justice and la, 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 and renewables this, renewables that. Okay, well, Wood Mackenzie in 2019 estimated that converting our grid to renewables, just converting electricity to renewables in the U.S., forget industrial demand, transportation demand, residential demand for liquid and gaseous fuels, you're talking about a $4.5 trillion price tag. Well, that's $35,000 per family in the United States. It just mocks the entire idea of an energy justice. How are working parents who are not part of the keyboard economy, how are they ever going to pay for that? They're not. I don't want to say it's a bad joke. I think it's just this, I don't even know the right word, and I'm paid to write, but I can't quite form the right description for how misguided, how regressive, how angry it makes me, because I just find it so disgusting, the whole way this has been sold and packaged by some, frankly, very elite and extraordinarily well-funded pressure groups.
Mm-hmm. You did coin a new phrase there, energy humanism. That's kind of what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
How have you seen, and this is obviously a big question, but how have you seen a shift from the previous administration to our current administration within the energy industry? I mean, I know there's thousands of things we can pick apart, but what's the biggest or the top few things that you've noticed in that shift?
Well, I here's how I'd put it, Kate, was I knew it was going to be different. I didn't know it was going to be this radical. Mm-hmm. I say this not as a partisan. I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat. I'm disgusted. But I was no fan of Trump. But Trump, when it came to the energy business, he had an intuitive understanding, even though he couldn't necessarily, enunciate it. Mm-hmm. He had an intuitive understanding of the essentiality of a healthy energy industry in the United States. And he wasn't afraid to say it. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Biden administration, we're going to have the FTC look at high oil prices. Why are oil prices so high? Well, hello, dumbass. I'm sorry, President, dumbass. Uh-huh. If you have less supply, price goes up. That's axiomatic. Mm-hmm. It has always been the case. Mm-hmm. And so there's been this continual trying to scapegoating by this administration to say, blame those oil and gas guys. They just don't know what they're doing. And even Secretary Granholm, I mean, in that famous and disastrous interview she had on with Tom Keene on Bloomberg, saying where he said, "Well, what is the administration going to do to decrease oil prices?" She goes, "How would I ever know how to do that?" Well, I mean, do you really even understand your business? You're the Secretary of Energy. Maybe you could look into this and understand why some of these policies that your boss is promoting are so dangerous in terms of affordability of energy in America. And I think the Democrats are starting to realize, hey, this is a real problem for them. It's a real political problem, particularly with the midterms coming up next year.
Yeah, we've seen some that actually have said, these higher prices for gasoline and some of these other products are going to cause people to use less of it, and that will drive us toward even more renewables. Well, if we start doing that, the term death spiral comes into mind, that, we get higher and higher prices and we add more and more renewables and it gets more and more unreliable. And, we're heading toward a disaster.
Well, and their response has been, well, this is why we need to accelerate the transition. Well, there is no transition when it comes to automobiles. I mean, yeah. You know, yes, Tesla's now, you know, they're, and EVs are 2% of the market or maybe 3% of the market. Okay, congratulations. But those cars are being bought by the rich. They're not being bought by the working poor. They're not being, you know, by the people who are, who don't live, as Jennifer Hernandez says, in the keyboard economy. These are people who have to get to work. And I think it's particularly important, you know, given, you know, North Dakota, where is that energy burden going to fall the most heavily? It's going to fall on working class people in rural areas because they tend to have to drive longer distances. So this is all going to be entirely having a big regressive effect on them, perhaps more than any other group of workers in America.
As you noted, though, political reality is beginning to set in. We're starting to see that in the polling numbers. Joe Biden's numbers, I think I saw today, 36% approval rating. That's pretty doggone poor. And, you know, we're coming into the midterm elections and, you know, seeing poll numbers that aren't looking good for the Democrats who are advocating these anti-fossil fuel types of policies. So 2022 shapes up to be an interesting
how tone deaf they are, though, in terms of this, these issues around the class of people that they say they represent, right? The Democrats have always presented themselves, long presented themselves, excuse me, as the party of the working class. But it's flipped now so that the GOP really, and I think Trump is, you know, the clearest example of that. He, you know, he appealed to the working class voters in a way that the Democrats don't. And you see that as well. And it's a point that I made when I was in, you know, spoke to the Lignite Council, was that there's this growing split between urban America and rural America, and it's getting more, it's getting deeper and deeper. And so that the Republicans are, you know, generally get their votes in rural areas and the Democrats just go to the cities. And that's why, of course, they want to eliminate the Electoral College, because they don't want to have to go to, you know, those flyover places like, you know, North Dakota and South Dakota and, you know, Kansas and Oklahoma. Oh yeah, forget them. You know, they don't vote for us anyway. We'll just go to Los Angeles and Chicago.
So what's next for you, Robert? Where are you headed now? What next on your agenda?
I'm going to take a couple of days off, Jeff.
What are you going to do in 2022 to get the word out? I guess maybe where
I'm actually setting up my speaking business next year is already getting, you know, lined out pretty well. But I'm actually working on a new documentary on renewables, in fact, and I'm going to be looking hard at California. We're going to be doing some shooting out in California in the next few weeks because California, more than any other province in America, shows the dangers and the regressiveness of these energy and climate policies that are being pushed by the Democrats. So I'm excited about that. I don't have another book in the works. I don't know that I can do another book. I'm kind of thinking I might be done with footnotes for a while, but yeah, and I'm going to continue doing my podcast and, doing, you know, articles and for, you know, Forbes and elsewhere, because, these issues are key and they're ones that I'm passionate about and the ones that I feel a responsibility, and a purpose about, that I have been given, you know, some advantage in being able to understand and explain these things. So that's my plan, is to push these messages out, because they're incredibly important.
Now, two things for our listeners too. I'll make sure to link that Senate hearing as well. I want to make sure everybody has access to that. So I'll have that linked in our podcast. Robert, where can our listeners and viewers, where can they find out more about your books, where to purchase your books, your speaking engagements?
Sure. Well, I'm easy to find on the Google, on the interweb. RobertBryce.com is my website. I'm on Twitter at PowerHungry, PWR Hungry. The film you can find on the web at JuiceTheMovie.com. My podcast is PowerHungryPodcast.com. So, like I said, I'm pretty easy to find.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing with us. It's just been really insightful and definitely, I can see the passion, and I appreciate everything that you've done for the industry. It's, you're shaking things up, and we need that right now.
Well, that's very kind. Thanks. I'm always happy to talk about these issues, and, was really pleased to come and talk to the Lignite Council and see the plant and the, you know, just the, you know, I love seeing, like I said, industrial plants like that, and love going to North Dakota, Montana. You know, I love this country, and I just love seeing, you know, how it works. And so, but energy is fundamental. Energy is the economy, as Art Berman says, and we need to pay attention to it.
Amen to that. Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it. And we look forward to seeing what, like Jeff said, 2022 has in store for you.
Great. Thanks, y'all.
Thanks, awesome. Robert.
Thank you for listening to another episode of MIND, America's Lignite Energy Podcast. For more information on lignite energy in North Dakota, visit lignite.com.